Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. We are glad that you've decided to join us. And Jim, not a lot of talk, given all the excitement over Egypt, and rightly so, over the past several days about the health care debate. We know the House Republicans repealed it pretty much along a party line vote. Three Democrats went along with it. And it probably won't get too far in the Senate, but hopefully we'll at least get a vote so people can get on the record for it. But despite the fact that it's not likely to happen, only 41% of Americans, according to Rasmussen in his latest survey on this, think that it's going to be repealed at any point. 58% still think that it should be. So usually this kind of ebbs and flows with what people think is likely to happen. Is it really worth still doing this? Almost 3 in 5 still think it is, and that's a really good sign.
It is, Greg, and I'm going to kind of give a surprising angle to this that kind of came as a surprise to me. I'd kind of been keeping one eye on the efforts to repeal health care through the courts to argue that the mandate is unconstitutional. But I kind of had figured that, look, this was passed legislatively. I wanted to see it repealed legislatively, and kind of figured that this the main fight was not really, you know, in the court battles. Spoke to Randy Barnett, a Georgetown law professor who's been involved in the repeal efforts, a very, very smart guy. And he managed to put it even in terms that laymen like me can understand. And this very interesting angle, which is that, you know, Supreme Court justices pay attention to public opinion, even though they're not really supposed to be following which way the wind blows. They, you know, they very much are aware of what the public's perspective is. And the way he put it was that if this was a very popular bill, there's almost no chance it would be repealed. That, you know, obviously there are 4 votes on the Supreme Court that are going to, you know, if it involved killing 1 out of every 10 Americans through death panels, they'd still say it was constitutional. You know, that the liberal justices are going to vote the way the Obama administration wants them to. But of the 5, that if it was very popular, they, you know, the strict constructionists would feel very wary about repealing something that was very popular if it had a plausible constitutional argument. But the fact that it's remaining unpopular, he thinks, kind of opens the door a little bit wider to a judicial review that comes to the conclusion that no, the mandate is not constitutional. So it's kind of intriguing. The legal fight is not occurring in a vacuum. And so he kind of felt it was very important that the perception be that this is a very unpopular bill. The American people don't want it. And not only that, that if they struck it down as unconstitutional, they would be, you know, not just 5 robed masters, you know, echoing this conclusion of what's constitutional and isn't. They would be reinforcing a broad American public perspective of what is constitutional. So, kind of interesting little kind of an indicator of that. Obviously, look, you know, when you head into a legal fight like this, you really have no margin for error, and it'll be some time before this ends up being resolved. But I thought it was an interesting, interesting impact that polls you see from Rasmussen and such could end up having a tiny bit of an influence on the thinking of the Supreme Court.
So keep it up, America. Justice Kennedy's paying attention is what we're trying to tell you here. And also, in terms of the legal fight, we had the judge in Virginia, and now, if he hasn't already, we're expecting a judge in Florida today to also declare the individual mandate unconstitutional, which, by my bean counting, puts it at 2-2 in different district courts around the country, which puts the good guys at least on equal footing. And with the public opinion where it is, I'd say even better than equal footing. So let's hope that on both tracks things keep happening here, both legislatively and in the courts. On to the bad martini now, and obviously we have to spend some time on Egypt today, and there's plenty of bad news to consider about what is happening and what might be happening soon there. One of the things I heard this morning, Jim, and I haven't heard this confirmed by a lot of places, but it appears that even Mohammed al-Baradei might not be an acceptable partner for the Muslim Brotherhood, and I'm not sure who asked them to be a partner in any future government anyway. So the fact that even a guy who's adored by the UN is not acceptable means that if these people get power one way or another, it's going to be pretty bad news economically, militarily in the region, ending 30-plus years of peace with Israel. The way that the power vacuum here is potentially being filled, if in fact Mubarak leaves anytime soon, not very encouraging.
Yeah, the possibility of a Baradei Muslim Brotherhood alliance, which was kind of the big talk over the weekend, kind of like the way a Reese's Pieces brings together two great tastes we love, a Baradei Muslim Brotherhood partnership is two tastes we hate. You've got all of the extremism and radicalism of the Muslim Brotherhood, and the kind of namby-pamby UN diplomat speak of al-Baradei kind of turning a blind eye to the Iranian nuclear program and Everything we disdain about the useless, ineffectual international institutions, kind of brought together in one wonderful flavor of terribleness. Frustrating. It's interesting because my comments earlier in the week, particularly on Friday, were interpreted as yay protesters, which wasn't completely my interpretation. And people really didn't like when I said, if you support the right of the Tea Parties to protest their ineffectual government, I understand why you deny an Egyptian the same rights. But my aim was not to say, oh, look, it's the Tea Parties protesting in the streets of Cairo. My aim is to say, you look at the Egyptian society right now. I'm going to clean this up because we're on a family podcast, Greg. It stinks. It really, really stinks. Not only is there massive poverty rates, they've always had massive poverty rates. And with the food prices are increasing, so people are afraid they're not going to be able to feed their families. And under Mubarak, who's thinking of running for one more 5 or 6 year term, there was just no prospect of things getting any better. And so I think a lot of Egyptians kind of said, look, we have nothing left to lose here. Let's make our push. Let's try to overthrow this and put something new in there, because no matter who's in charge, if they're different, there's a possibility that the change would be an improvement. And on some human level, I cannot resent the average Egyptian protesting in the streets. Now, this is not to say that the Muslim Brotherhood getting power would be good in any way, shape, or form. It would be terrible for our interests. And in fact, you could argue that we have a lot of we have limited options in dealing with Egypt, and most of them are bad, and a lot of them are worse. But considering how it looks like the outlook for Mubarak grows more and more ominous each day, Greg, I'm no expert in retaining power in closed political systems, but it looks more and more like the only way Mubarak keeps power in this is if there is a really brutal crackdown on everybody out in the streets protesting. And Greg, I don't know about you, I don't really want that to be the American position. Go out and kill a lot of people in the streets. That doesn't, it doesn't really seem like the way we would not just live consistently with our values. It would be, a wonderful gift to every anti-American throughout the Middle East. So as much as the situation is bad, I prefer seeing our government having a tone of sympathy to the average Egyptian trying to make ends meet, trying to, hope for some sort of something better in the future than a standard, we stand by our friend Hosni Mubarak and every one of his guys who are out there, shooting protesters and such.
Well, obviously in the perfect world, there would be the vast majority of the people who are out there who are having very legitimate grievances would have a recognizable figure who could be someone acceptable, even if Mubarak would reluctantly go. It's just the fact that that person doesn't appear to exist right now. So what we see right now is possible replacements, not encouraging. So on to number three now, and back to the domestic political realm. And, of course, you mentioned the Tea Parties, and the Tea Party obviously having a major role not only in the swing and majority of the House of Representatives, but also in kind of purging some of the rhinos out during the primaries of the 2010 cycle. Now the Democrats are kind of worried about this too. The establishment Democrats, Stephen Lynch of Massachusetts, voted against Obamacare, and as a result of that, he had a major challenge in the Democratic primary from on the liberal side. And now, since he survived that, easily won re-election, he's basically saying that liberal groups should not try to oust liberal Democratic incumbents because ultimately we're all on the same page here. So good to see that they're encouraging fierce debate within their own party and aren't afraid at all of exchanging ideas.
Yeah, a couple interesting points in his comments. The first is, I'm not sure I agree with his assessment that the primary problem for Democrats was liberal primary challenges. He says he thinks it kind of cost him 6 to 8 seats, and I would love to hear his picks of which ones they were, because most Democrats came, if they came out of their primaries weakened, it was generally because of a larger political environment and the fact that the country did not like that the economy was lousy. They did not like health care. They did not like kind of the whole entire tone, the refusal to meet with constituents in some places. Really, you look at it top to bottom. Maybe you could argue Blanche Lincoln, was hurt, had to expend a lot of resources in her primary. But, as soon as she won her primary and she trailed heavily from beginning to end. So it's not like, Arkansas was ready to love Democrats who'd voted for health care there. So I think his math is off. I think his interpretation is off. But then I love his conclusion is, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee should be going talk to those groups and get them to stop doing those primary challenges. Okay, ask nicely. I'm sure they'll be receptive to that message. Maybe if you say please a whole lot of times, outreach can always help a little bit. But generally, if they think that somebody's a mushy moderate who hasn't stood up for their principles – asking him nicely not to challenge him. That's just going to enrage him more. And you wonder, have these people ever met, you know, progressive activists? These people get angry when the sun comes up in the morning, and they're angry when it goes down in the evening. The idea that, you know, they're going to be able to sweet talk them into stopping funding primary challenges does not seem like a, you know, likely scenario. But, you know, I guess there's an old saying that if you want something in life, the first step is to ask for it. So we'll see how Stephen Lynch's request goes.
Well, it's going to go better, I think, because there aren't that many Democratic incumbents left. So challenge away on all these new Republicans, and all the ones that are left, apparently except for the three who voted to repeal Obamacare, are pretty much your type of liberal progressive activists out there. So have fun with that.
A good way of putting it is, yes, because of that, you will see many fewer liberal challenges to incumbent Democrats this year, but it's because there are a lot fewer incumbent Democrats.
That's right. Exactly. Ah, Jim, what a start to the week.
Indeed.
We'll talk to you tomorrow. Have a good one.
Looking forward to it, Greg. See you.
Thanks. Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Join us Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.